Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Brian Miller with United for a Fair Economy, who talks about the consequences of extending Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthy, growing income inequality in the U.S., and his group's effort to build a movement for tax fairness. Bill Van Esveld of Human Rights Watch, who talks about his recent investigation, which documents specific and egregious discrimination against Palestinian residents living in sectors of the West Bank controlled by Israel. And Joe Torres, with the media reform group Free Press, who explains why he believes the Federal Communication Commission's approval of so-called net neutrality rules are a sellout to the telecommunications industry. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
After a failed attempt to bomb an airliner on Christmas Day 2009 over Detroit, top leaders in the Yemen government warned American diplomats its nuclear storage facility was not secure and was vulnerable to a terrorist attack. Yemen has been the center of several terror plots, including the Christmas bombing incident. According to a secret U.S. diplomatic cable published by WikiLeaks and dated January 9, 2010, the Yemen official warned, "Very little stands in the way between bad guys and Yemen's nuclear material." Yemen's lower radioactive material storage facility is used by hospitals and universities engaged in agricultural research. There is concern that the nuclear material could be used to make a dirty bomb, a device mixing explosives with nuclear material that could contaminate a large area. Since the secret cable was sent last January to the CIA, FBI, and the Department of Homeland Security, Yemen has moved its nuclear storage facility to a more secure site. Yemen is the Arab world's poorest country and a major hotspot for Al-Qaeda. The investigative news agency ProPublica reports that the Obama White House is preparing a new executive order on indefinite detention, which will allow regular reviews of evidence for dozens of prisoners held at the U.S. prison camp in Guantanamo Bay. The executive order has been in the works for nearly 18 months, and it will help define the Obama administration's long-term policy toward high-value detainees, including those held indefinitely without trial. Nearly 2 years ago, President Obama promised to close the Guantanamo detention facility, but has faced stiff resistance from Congress, as well as deteriorating political conditions in Yemen and other home countries of detainees. Currently, 48 prisoners are held under indefinite detention. The number is expected to increase in coming months due to administrative transfers. The draft executive order would give these detainees a review every 6 months and a more comprehensive annual review. In 2008, Guantanamo detainees won the right to challenge the lawfulness of their detention in court, which is separate from the new White House executive order that would examine the necessity of extended detention. Jamil Jaffer of the American Civil Liberties Union noted the draft order was an improvement over the current situation, but he warned that the order would normalize and institutionalize indefinite detention, and other anti-terror policies devised by the Bush administration, presenting a profound threat to human rights and the rule of law. The global debt crisis may find a new victim in 2011, major cities in the United States and Europe. Meredith Whitney, a top Wall Street analyst, thinks municipal finance may be the next egg to crack in the American economy. In late December, Whitney told 60 Minutes, "There is no doubt in my mind that you will see a spate of municipal bond defaults." According to the Guardian newspaper, American cities and states owe over $2 trillion to creditors. Similarly, in Europe, local and regional governments have borrowed over 1.3 trillion euros. Now, cities like Detroit and Madrid are struggling to provide basic public services like street cleaning. In the U.S., state governments now spend $500 billion more than they collect each year in tax revenue. State governments also face over $1 trillion in pension obligations. The crisis has pushed the state of Arizona to sell the state capitol and Supreme Court buildings in a leaseback deal. Andre Rodriguez-Pose of the London School of Economics warned, cities are on their own. Central governments won't come to the rescue as they have problems of their own. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Liz Becker.
Despite strong opposition from progressive activists and some legislators, President Obama's deal with Republicans to maintain the Bush-era tax cuts for the next 2 years to benefit the wealthiest Americans won approval in both the House and Senate and was signed into law on December 17th. While the tax measure continues unemployment benefits for another 13 months and cuts payroll taxes by 2%, the extension of tax cuts for America's richest citizens maintains the Republican trickle-down policy that is one of the least effective ways to create new jobs, according to most economists. One aspect of the tax deal that generated much anger on the left was the rollback of the estate tax. Instead of imposing the scheduled tax rate of 55% for individuals worth more than $1 million in 2011, the Obama GOP deal will allow individuals to exempt estates up to $5 million for individuals and $10 million for couples, but pay a 35% tax rate beyond that. This dramatic reduction in the estate tax that only affects the nation's wealthiest families is at its lowest rate since 1928. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy, who talks about the consequences of extending tax cuts for the wealthy, growing income inequality in the U.S., and his group's effort to build a movement for tax fairness and a more just and inclusive economy.
It was an unnecessary and very expensive tax giveaway. The Obama GOP deal will cost $800 billion over the next 2 years, and that's the tax cut portion of that. And 25% of those cuts are going to go to the top 1% of income earners alone. And, you know, and this is on top of the $2.5 trillion that the Bush tax cuts have already cost us since initially passed. So, you know, it's been a very expensive game that we've been playing, and it's been driving up deficits. And those deficits are being used as justification for cutting back on important things like unemployment insurance, like important job creation programs that actually do create more meaningful jobs. So, you know, it's not pretty for the next 2 years, but we're obviously going to be doing a lot of work to put the nation on more solid financial grounds and more solid footing for the kind of economic development policies that are actually going to create real jobs for working Americans and promote a more broadly shared prosperity. And that's not what just passed, unfortunately. It's going to be a different package, but that's what we're going to be fighting for in 2012.
Brian, tell us a little bit about one of the very important aspects of this tax cut package, which was lowering the estate tax for the wealthiest Americans to an 80-year low. What's the short and long-term impact of that big tax cut?
Sure. I mean, and as you mentioned, that was one of the pieces that generated the most outrage among members of the progressive Democratic caucus, the Congressional Black Caucus, and others, was that the estate tax was established nearly 100 years ago as an important fundamental bedrock feature of preventing America from becoming the kind of aristocracies that we saw in old Europe. Right, where a few families, through inherited wealth, through wealth being transferred from generation to generation, come to dominate the entire economy and the political sphere at the same time. They recognized that at the early part of the century, and they passed the estate tax in order to help rein in that and promote an economic system that really encourages meritocracy, which means every generation that comes into this world is able to achieve or fail on their own accord, not because of who their parents were or who their grandparents were. And any further weakening of the estate tax really erodes that core value system that's important to our nation. And, you know, on a real dollar-for-dollar standpoint, I mean, and it's important to remember how weak the estate tax already was in 2009. In 2009, the child of a wealthy couple could inherit more tax-free than the average American earns in four lifetimes. But that wasn't weak enough. So the Republicans pushed to make it even weaker. And so now instead of a $3.5 million exemption, we have a $5 million exemption, $10 million for couples. And this is only going to deepen the wealth divide. And it's only going to further concentrate wealth in the hands of the few. And we need to turn this country back and start promoting policies that actually build, lift up Main Street and promote a more broadly shared prosperity. And again, that's what we're going to be working for in the next 2 years.
I wanted to ask you further, Brian, about this. How do the Republican tax cuts and their general trickle-down economic philosophy championed by Ronald Reagan and his disciples, how has that, if at all, affected the redistribution of wealth from the poor and middle class to the nation's wealthiest citizens? And how does it relate to the growing disparity between the rich and poor in the United States?
What we've seen is since the days of Ronald Reagan, as you, and that's really the benchmark. It was during Ronald Reagan's tenure that the top income tax bracket, I mean, we used to have top income tax brackets of 70% when Reagan came in office. That got cut down to 28% during his tenure, right? Now, granted, that only applied to people who had very, very high incomes. I mean, even now, you have to earn almost $400,000 before you hit the top 35% bracket. But that coupled with the type of large-scale public investments that our government did, you know, back in the 60s when we built the interstate highway system, we were launching rockets and sending, you know, spaceships to the moon. You know, we were doing massive public investments in the aerospace industry and our transportation infrastructure. All of this was funded through taxpayer dollars, and it created a huge economic boom for Americans. That coupled with the strong unions, the progressive tax systems, between the late 40s and the late 70s, income across the board grew. From the bottom 20% of income earners to the top 20% of income earners, everyone saw dramatic growth in their personal income. You know, if you look at what's happened over the last 30 years since Reaganomics began and the trickle-down philosophies came to rule the policy decisions, what we've seen is that almost all the income growth has gone to the very top, in that the bottom 60 to 80% of Americans have seen very little, if any, real growth in their income after you adjust for inflation. And that is really what's fundamentally weakening our economy right now. The basic crux of the congressional Republicans' argument is that the reason our economy is not doing well is that rich people don't have enough money, and that if we just give them more tax break, they'll create jobs and so forth. But it's a complete misread. Right now, income inequality is at the highest level it's been since 1928, just before the Great Depression. And yet they're still holding to this argument that the problem with our economy is that rich people don't have enough money. The problem with our economy, the real problem with our economy, is that the middle class has been eroding and weakened over the last 30 years to the point that they don't have the purchasing power to buy the goods our economy produces anymore. And until we start rebuilding and reinvesting in that middle class, we're not going to get our nation back on track again.
That was Brian Miller, Executive Director of United for a Fair Economy. Contact the group by calling area code 617-423-2148. Or visit their website at faireconomy.org. Human Rights Watch has just released a report titled Separate and Unequal, Israel's Discriminatory Treatment of Palestinians in the Occupied Palestinian Territories, which documents specific and egregious discrimination against Palestinian residents of Area C of the West Bank, which is an area exclusively controlled by Israel, not the Palestinian Authority. Material for the report was collected through interviews with Palestinians in several villages, with Israeli settlers in the West Bank, and from two leaked Israeli government reports documenting conditions in both the settlements, which are considered illegal under international law, and settlement outposts, which are considered illegal even by Israel. Among other things, the report documents the scarcity of water in Palestinian communities, while nearby settlements have swimming pools, and Palestinian children studying by candlelight as nearby Israeli settlements light up the night with electricity from the grid. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Bill Van Esveld, a Middle East researcher with Human Rights Watch based in Jerusalem and the author of the Separate and Unequal report. Speaking by phone from Israel, he describes the conditions investigated and explains some of Human Rights Watch proposals for easing discrimination.
What we found was pretty striking. In one case, in the northern Jordan Valley, which is up in the northeastern part of the West Bank, there's a Palestinian village that used to be a farming community. And when Israel occupied the area, drilled some wells and set up some civilian settlements that are mostly agricultural. And the new wells drilled by Israel to service those agricultural settlements basically dried out the Palestinian wells. Now, the Palestinians have lost about half of the amount of agricultural land that they used to be able to cultivate, while the Israeli settlements, you know, there's a swimming pool in one of them that also operates a little guest house for tourists, and they're exporting a lot of agricultural crops to European and other markets. Meanwhile, Palestinians are actually going into debt or into poverty, and in some cases have basically had to move out of that town to other areas of the West Bank in hopes of just being able to make a living.
Is that part of the intent, to remove Palestinians from more land in the West Bank?
Well, we don't have any sort of smoking gun document that would demonstrate an Israeli intent to empty out Area C of Palestinians. There's not evidence to back up such a claim. What there is evidence of is the fact that just Palestinians are leaving. In many cases, they have left communities in Area C because, they told us, it's just impossible to continue living there. Many of them are not connected to the water network, or if they are connected, they turn on their tap and it's often nothing comes out. In light of that, they have to buy water in water tankers that are driven along roads behind tractors. Even the water tankers can be confiscated if they're not properly permitted. So people have effectively been forced to leave their homes.
And one of the rationales that Israelis use for continuing to build settlements is to allow for what they call natural increase, that is to allow families to expand their homes as their families expand, right?
Right. Well, this is an irony. There actually is a building freeze going on in the West Bank right now, but it's not being imposed against settlers. It's being imposed against Palestinians living in Area C. And it's so severe that, in fact, there is no natural growth being allowed in Palestinian communities. That's the sort of discrimination that we've found, and it spans a lot of areas of everyday life that don't seem to have any rational benefit to Israeli security or even the welfare of settlers living nearby. It seems unnecessarily harsh and punitive.
Bill Van Esveld, Human Rights Watch has noted Israel's legitimate security concerns. And Israel justifies these restrictions in the West Bank on that basis. Isn't that right?
We take that into account. But no security argument can conceivably explain refusing to allow somebody to build a water tank or a house or a medical clinic or a school. There's just to claim that that's a security concern seems absurd. In other cases, there is a security argument, such as preventing people from moving on roads or erecting roadblocks or checkpoints. But those security limitations and freedom of movement limitations have been imposed in a really blanket fashion that basically target all Palestinians moving on those roads as if they were all security threats, old women, old men, you know, babies, the lot of them. And that is just treating an entire population as if every one of them is a security threat based on nothing but their ethnicity or national origin. And you can limit people's freedom of movement, but you have to do so on a tailored and specific basis. You can't just say that everybody who happens to look a certain way is a security threat, and therefore we can prevent them from moving around. Meanwhile, of course, settlers have special bypass roads that are built for them, while Palestinians are prevented from paving their roads and have to navigate numerous roadblocks and checkpoints.
Your report says, quote, "Donor countries must avoid complicity in violations of international law caused by the settlements." In other words, where settlements are draining resources, and it says the European Union should identify cases where discrimination against Palestinians contributed to the production of goods that are then sent to the EU and other places. It seems like that would cover all goods produced in the settlements.
Well, it could. Basically, we made that recommendation because we only examined in detail a few specific cases. So we don't have the facts to make an argument that all businesses that are taking part in settlements are in some way directly themselves contributing to discrimination against Palestinians. But what we're saying is that there's a lot of evidence out there that that might be the case, and that businesses often claim to have their own human rights or ethical standards. The United Nations has put out a framework for how businesses should behave to take human rights concerns into account. So what we're saying is that businesses need to be on notice. If you're a business and you have activities in settlements, you need to be on notice that there's a lot of severe discrimination going on there, and you need to carefully and independently review your activities to make sure that you're not complicit in it. And if you are, you have to take the appropriate steps to mitigate and prevent that contribution to violations of human rights. And if necessary, if the only way to do that is to stop your operations there, then you need to do so.
What has been the Israeli response to your report?
We've had informal meetings with a number of Israeli officials who were, to my pleasant surprise, quite supportive of the report's findings and concerned by them. But, you know, those people were not in the Prime Minister's office. The official response has been quite harsh. Unfortunately, that's fairly predictable. But we hope that the Israeli government will see this report as constructive criticism. The report is basically calling on Israel to, of course, abide by its obligations under the Geneva Conventions to withdraw its settlers and dismantle the settlements. But that may take a while. But what it could immediately and should immediately do is stop discriminatory policies that are harming Palestinians.
That was Bill Van Esveld, a Middle East researcher with Human Rights Watch based in Jerusalem and author of the Separate and Unequal Report. To read the report online, visit the group's website at hrw.org or call Human Rights Watch at area code 212-290-4700. By a 3-2 vote on December 21st, the Federal Communications Commission approved what they labeled as new net neutrality rules they assert are intended to prevent giant telecommunications companies like AT&T and Verizon from acting as powerful internet gatekeepers. The media reform group Free Press strongly criticized the rules, stating that they're riddled with loopholes which benefit the nation's largest telecommunication corporations. The group further complained that the rules do little to prevent phone and cable companies from segregating the Internet into a superhighway with fast access for some and slow lanes for others, determined by the size of content providers' wallets. Free Press also objected to the rules' inherent discrimination against wireless users and the weak rules applied to wired networks. A coalition of free Internet activist groups have expressed disappointment with the FCC vote and accused President Obama of betraying his 2008 campaign pledge to preserve an open Internet and protect consumers. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Joe Torres, senior advisor for government relations and external affairs with the media reform group Free Press. He takes a critical look at the FCC's new rules and describes the enormous influence of the telecommunications companies that lobbied hard to obstruct all real effective net neutrality rules.
So we're calling it fake net neutrality because even though the chairman is trying to claim victory and say that he fulfilled President Obama's campaign promise, he'll take a backseat to no one in his support for net neutrality, what the chairman actually voted on is that the whole fight over net neutrality is trying to prevent these companies from discriminating online. And what we mean by discriminating online means they have the ability to slow up or speed up web traffic, whether it's your website or an application. And if they're able to do that, they can create these economic barriers that would prevent the smaller guy from competing. What may happen now is that if you want your website to be seen by the public at the fastest speeds, you're going to have to pay more to make sure the public can access your site at the fastest speed. But meanwhile, you're also competing against companies that have deeper pockets who can pay to make sure their sites are sped up. So those who can't afford to have their site sped up will be slowed down. And that will fundamentally change the way the Internet has always worked. The Internet has always worked in a way in which the ISPs had to treat all web traffic equally. And what the FCC voted on basically has destroyed that framework that's always existed. So on wireless, it's even worse. So on wireless is actually everything I just described, but also these companies have the ability to block applications and websites on wireless as well. So it goes even further on wireless on the harms they can cause.
What do you think caused the FCC and the chairman to backtrack so fundamentally on the pledge by Obama and this FCC themselves to bolster net neutrality as opposed to blowing all these loopholes through it?
The power of these corporations is the power of AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. These companies are amongst the most powerful corporations in D.C. lobbying. Literally last year we found that close to $100 million was spent by the telecom industry with over 500 lobbyists, and they have deep pockets. They employ former members of Congress and former Democratic FCC staff members. You had, over this past year, you had close to 80 Democrats calling on the FCC not to pass net neutrality. So you had all the Republicans and about 80 Democrats telling the SEC not to move forward with this. He had all that political pressure from within his own party, and that's because of the power of the telecom companies able to work the Hill and get support from the Hill against the FCC. So over the course of the year, they slowly wore this chairman down, and this chairman, instead of acting as an independent regulator, he was more concerned about how the political winds in Congress. And so this is how we got here.
Joe, what are the next steps here? I've heard that with last year's D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruling that the FCC overstepped its authority to regulate the Internet, that this set of flawed, loophole-ridden net neutrality rules could be in jeopardy. Is that something that is a silver lining here, that this rule may not go into effect? Or what are the options that groups like yours have in the public at large to push for really a true net neutrality rules?
The SEC actually published its order late last week, right before everyone went away for Christmas. So we're looking through the fine print. Hopefully there's good transparency rules in there that will allow us to document the abuses and the harm that's being caused by these rules. But the legality of this is a great question, because what the courts found earlier this year was that the legal foundation that was established during the Bush administration, during the Bush years, the SEC deregulated the broadband industry. It moved broadband from what's called a Title II service to a Title I. It was a deregulatory move to make sure these companies didn't have competitors. The courts found that the framework in which the FCC was regulating broadband under this Title I distinction, which the Bush administration established, was not legal. So the FCC had the choice, this chairman, Julius Genachowski, had a decision that he can re-regulate the industry by moving broadband back into a Title II service. He chose not to pass these network neutrality rules under a more sound legal footing. And so what's going to happen is going to go back to court, and the likelihood that this is going to get knocked down is great. While that may seem like a silver lining, here you have President Obama, who's seen as a network neutrality champion, put in his mark on what he says net neutrality is. And now, if these rules are not stayed, you're going to have all sorts of bad practices beginning to happen. And it's always difficult to put the genie back in the bottle to fight that, you know, but this is what we have to do. We're going to make the case in court. Hopefully, if there's a court case, I don't know if we're going to sue or not. We're thinking about that. But there's still a lot of fight left to be had.
That was Joe Torres, Senior Advisor for Government Relations and External Affairs with the media reform group Free Press. Contact Free Press toll-free at 877-888-1533 or visit their SaveTheInternet.com website. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-268-8446 or write to Between the Lines, care of Squeaky Wheel Productions, P.O. Box 110176, Trumbull, Connecticut 06611. Visit our newly redesigned website at vtlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Liz Becker, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.